Oh, well, the first case we'll hear is number 16-2015, Cottrell versus Alcon Laboratories.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. My name is Leah Nichols, and I represent the appellants, Leonard Cottrell et al., and I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
That'll be granted.
Plaintiffs have Article III standing to bring their consumer claims against defendants. Plaintiffs are purchasers of defendants' prescription eye drops, and defendants' illegal conduct caused large portions of that medication to be unusable and wasted. Here, the injury is the money that plaintiffs have already spent on medication that they were unable to use. This pocketbook injury is a paradigmatic injury in fact, and it gives rise to Article III standing here.
Isn't this just a case about package efficiency?
Your Honor, it's a case about an unfair business practice. So here, the Article III injury is the fact that the consumer purchased medication, and we're not talking about a few extra drops of medication here, Your Honor. We're talking about the fact that half the bottle of medication or two-thirds of the bottle of the medication was unusable. And that the fact that they had to spend money on that is what gives rise to Article III standing. Now, it's a separate question about whether they've stated a claim under state consumer law in this context. So even though a consumer might have Article III standing to bring a claim, they still have to meet that standard. So when we're
When I get a prescription for eye drops and the doctor says take two drops twice a day for 10 days, and I always expect at the end of the 10 days that there is going to be a quantity left in the bottle, that doesn't bother me. If I get conjunctivitis again, I'll probably use it up without a doctor's prescription. That's beside the point. But the fact that I get a little bit more than what is necessary for the number of drops prescribed has never seemed to me to be a problem. You couldn't, if it was just the number of drops prescribed, you couldn't get the last drop out of the bottle. And when I miss my eye putting an eye drop in, I'd be up the creek. So what's the problem with having some left over?
Your Honor, several responses to that. First, having a little bit left over may still very well be an Article III injury, but it probably doesn't state a claim under state law. So I think we're sort of normatively uncomfortable with that kind of claim going forward. But it goes forward, it doesn't go forward not because there's no Article III standing, because that would fail to state a claim under state law. The second thing I'd like to say in response is that these are different types of eye drops than the ones to which you refer, Your Honor. These are drops that the plaintiffs are forced to take every day for the rest of their lives. So it's not as if they get it and then it runs its course. They're going to keep purchasing bottles of this medication forever or until the end of their lives to avoid blindness.
Do the plaintiffs have a choice of, I guess, the size of the drop? Now, I saw your charts, and apparently all of the ones you list there are over what is necessary. Are there ones within?
No.
Okay.
No, there are not, Your Honor. All of the drops available, all the glaucoma drops available on the market today are all, again, two to three or more times the size that the scientific community has unanimously recommended for consumers. What we do know is that the relative size, and I think this goes to some of the concerns about the standing here, the relative size of the drop, so right now their drops say, 35 microliters versus 40 microliters, is a driver of the cost of treatment to the consumer. So there are two studies I'd like to particularly draw.
Is the relief you're seeking money, or is the relief you're seeking an adjustment to the delivery mechanism?
Both, Your Honor. Those are both requested relief in this case.
With respect to the latter,
yes.
the delivery mechanism, is the district court equipped to order such relief?
We believe it is, Your Honor, and I think your question is getting at the question about whether there would be FDA pre-approval.
Correct.
Required. That is the dispositive question in the preemption issue. However, which we're not going to talk about. however, we pled in the complaint that this is a change that is feasible for the defendants to have made. And the reason that we know that is that the defendants have in fact changed their droppers and have changed the size of the drop over time. And there is no public record that they sought or got FDA pre-approval for any of those changes.
How are you going to quantify the money damages in this case?
So we would quantify the money damages by taking the amount of money that each class member spent on the medication prorating that according to how much larger than 16 microliters the drops were. So, for example, if the drops were 32 microliters, then the consumers, we would propose that the consumers would be entitled to half their money back. Now, we haven't reached that stage in this litigation yet. I mean, I think it's important to note that this is a pure motion to dismiss only on the face of the complaint. There's been no evidence entered with regard to this issue. And standing is, of course, something that can always be revisited as more things come out.
Can I ask you a question? I don't think it's answered by the briefs, but there was some talk about adverse health effects from having too much medication. Are you saying that, in fact, people were injured, or is this just a mention? I'm not sure it was actually connected to actual injury.
Your Honor, we have alleged that it does increase the risk of injury. It does that for everyone, and we argued in our reply brief that that's another basis for standing. It hasn't been alleged as any.
So you're seeking relief for that as well?
Yes.
Any adverse health effects?
Right, okay. The increased risk of adverse health effects.
How do you distinguish your position?
None of the plaintiffs have suffered an adverse health effect. Is that correct?
We have not alleged that. That's correct. But it does, again, this is something that the plaintiffs will be taking going forward, and it does. The excess medication does increase the risk of side effects.
So defense counsel is going to cite Finkelman and suggest that you're speculating at best. How do you distinguish your situation from the plaintiffs in Finkelman?
Sure, Your Honor. There are a number of ways in which it's distinguishable, but I'm going to focus on one, and that's that in Finkelman, the plaintiff had failed to allege plausible facts showing that the NFL's alleged withholding of Super Bowl tickets would in fact contract the supply on the secondary market. There was no allegations to support that. This court did give credence to his basic economic theory, which was that if there is reduced supply, the cost will go up. But said Finkelman hadn't pled that. Here, what's at issue is whether or not the fact that if the drops were smaller, the consumers would have to spend less money. We think that is adequately pled here. One of the reasons it is because at least two of the studies actually ask the question, how much is the cost of treatment of relative drugs, and is that driven by the drop size? In particular, that's...
Does the FDA in any ways regulate the size of a drop or prescribe how big a drop should be?
No, Your Honor, it does not. That goes primarily to the preemption question, but as you'll see in the preemption argument, and none of the approvals for any of these drugs of which we're aware that's available in the public record, does the FDA regulate the size of the drop? No.
When the doctor has prescribed the medication in these cases, has the doctor given a prescription which covers a number of drops over a certain period of time, or simply said use this till it runs out?
Again, Your Honor, in this case, these are drugs that the person will presumably take forever.
Yeah, but the doctor prescribes. And when the doctor prescribes, do the doctor say, all right, for the next 30 days, take two drops twice a day, and then a new prescription will issue in 30 days after that?
Right, I think that's how it would work, Your Honor, but there's no information in the complaint with regard to that. So going back to the question about, does the drop size drive the cost of the medication in the course of treatment, the answer is yes. The Hartenbaum study, which was sponsored by Merck, and the Ventura study, both of which are discussed in the complaint, actually looked at this question, what drives the cost of treatment for consumers? And they concluded that standing here today, and this is not speculation, this is not, an assumption, they said standing here today, drugs that come in smaller drops are cheaper to consumers over the course of treatment. And again, that's a conclusion that a Merck study found. And that's on top of all the other articles.
What if the manufacturers just increase the price of the fluid?
Your Honor, the fact that certainly, I don't think that affects standing. And here's why. A manufacturer always has price discretion to increase or decrease the cost of whatever their product is. that doesn't defeat the fact that plaintiffs here, and this is their injury, that plaintiffs here have already spent the money on wasted products. It doesn't obviate that. And similarly, if we compare this to, this is an unfairness claim, so it's a little bit different than I think many other claims, although supported by the law. If you have a deception claim or a defective product claim, and the consumer says, well, my injury is the difference between what I thought I was getting and what I got. The defense that the manufacturer could have raised the prices or charged a different price would obviate injury in all of those cases. And so to say that that changes the fact that the consumer has already spent the money on medication they were forced to waste, doesn't, the fact that they could have charged something else doesn't change.
We have to look at each type of relief that you request. It seems to me, using Judge Restrepo's hypothetical, I mean, on a going forward basis, maybe equitable relief, if the other side skyrocketed their prices to compensate for whatever, to make sure their profits maintained, that would there be injury in fact to support equitable relief?
So I want to make sure I understand your question. So you're saying if they...
We have to look at each of the types of relief, I think, to see where they're standing.
Sure.
But, I mean, the fact that the laboratories can raise their prices anywhere they like, there may not be any actual injury, would there be, if they did that? That's hypothetical.
Right, yes. Again, that doesn't obviate the fact that they have standing about with regard to the damages. Right.
Okay.
As far as going forward, I think the equitable relief with... I think there would be injury whether or not they raise their prices if they were still forced to purchase medication they couldn't use. And so that's the heart of the injury here, whether we're talking about future or what's already happened. The heart of the injury is that they're forced to buy that medication that they can't use. And that fits squarely within the unfairness standard that the FTC has put out, right? There has to be a substantial injury to consumers that isn't reasonably avoidable by the consumers themselves and isn't outweighed by any countervailing benefits. And for the reasons...
But don't they use up the bottle of the medication before they buy a new bottle?
May I answer?
Yeah, you may.
Okay. Judge Roth, the answer is yes, but each time they use a drop, half or more of that drop is wasted. So it doesn't matter whether they get to the bottom of the bottle or not. Even if they get to the bottom of the bottle, throughout the course of using it, the consumer has been forced to throw away, essentially, rolls down their cheek or into their bloodstream, throw away half or more of each drop of medication. So how much is left in the bottle isn't relevant to the particular claims here.
Okay. Judge Roth, do you have anything else? Because your time's up.
No, I don't.
Okay, thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Robin Blado. I represent Pfizer, and I'll be arguing on behalf of the appellees. This case is a perfect example of where Article III courts should draw the jurisdictional line. The products worked exactly as they were supposed to. The plaintiffs weren't lied to in any way. They weren't physically or emotionally injured in any way. They admit that they got what they paid for. They say
arguing to us that the product didn't work effectively and that the delivery mechanism was too generous, so to speak.
Actually, they haven't argued that the product didn't work effectively in any way, shape, or form. They have argued that the product worked perfectly effectively.
But the delivery mechanism caused waste.
That the delivery mechanism, according to them, could have been improved. I mean, the argument here is that the product could have been improved, that it could have been made more efficient. They argue that they believe they've come up with a better way to make these FDA-approved products. Well, that's not Article III standing. That's not injury in fact, not under the jurisprudence of this court and the United States Supreme Court, or even under the ordinary meaning of the words injury.
But if you interpret their argument to suggest that they paid for medication they couldn't use, that you don't see any monetary damages there?
That they paid for medication that they couldn't use. I mean, they weren't
it was wasted.
They weren't forced to pay for anything. I mean, I think what they've done is they've tried to fit this case into a situation where they've been forced to pay for something that they've wasted. But they enter into
the statutes they seem to be suing under rely on this FTC unfairness statement, which talks about sellers being coerced into purchasing unwanted goods or services. I mean, wouldn't this be forced into purchasing unwanted, drops that roll down your cheeks or otherwise go into your bloodstream?
Well, absolutely not, because this is they're purchasing treatment. I mean, they're purchasing treatment for their ailments. And as Judge Roth noted or questioned, this is really a packaging efficiency issue. They're getting the treatment that they want, and they're getting every drop that they need, and they're not running out of drops before their prescriptions are up. There's no actual injury. The fact that they might have gotten more than they used is not an injury within any ordinary sense of the word, or injury in fact under Article 3. I mean, if it were, then a consumer could literally walk down the grocery aisles and pick any product that was overpackaged in some way. I mean, you could argue that plenty of products are inefficient in some way or could be improved. You could argue that
the consumer doesn't have to buy the big jug of peanut butter or doesn't have to order the large fries. These folks had to get their treatment, right?
Well, sure, they had to get their treatment, and they did get their treatment. But just because plaintiffs have chosen... I'm sorry, Judge Roth?
No, I think that's...
No, I didn't...
Oh, I'm sorry. Just, excuse me, then. Just because the plaintiffs have chosen to sue a group of defendants in one court does not mean that these defendants are acting collectively to control the marketplace in any way. They haven't articulated any or alleged any sort of conspiracy or collective action or anything like that. What they're trying to do is hold each individual defendant responsible for what the marketplace looks like. And the marketplace has these FDA-approved drugs that work exactly as they're supposed to. If they could be improved in some way, as plaintiffs allege, then plaintiffs are they're certainly welcome to pitch that idea to the market. But you can't hold these defendants responsible just because these are sight-saving drugs, that these drugs are needed in order to.
So what about, I think an interesting hypothetical is the one in the briefs about pumping gas. If you buy, let's say you buy $2, you think you're buying $2.50 worth of gas, but half of it ends up on the ground. You know, isn't that a problem?
That's not. Of course, that's a problem in the context of gas because you're actually paying for volume of gas. I mean, here you're paying for treatment. You're paying for a certain number of doses. There's no out.
But you're also paying. You're also paying for a volume of medication that comes in the bottle. And the plaintiffs are saying, if the drops were smaller, we could buy a smaller volume to cover the treatment that is prescribed in this course of treatment. And isn't that the fact that they could buy a smaller amount at a lesser cost an economic injury that they're suffering?
It would be if it wasn't entirely speculative. I mean, this product does not exist. This product hasn't been designed, tested, manufactured, approved by the FDA. This product is something that they believe should exist in the marketplace, but it doesn't. So just as a court can't assume that plaintiffs are going to save money if a hypothetical product someday comes into existence, it also can't assume that plaintiffs have wasted money because the hypothetical product wasn't used in the first place. Here, they have, sure, they purchased a volume of medication, but they purchased that volume in order to treat their ailment for a certain period of time. They haven't alleged anywhere that they ever ran out of medication before they needed to refill their prescription.
Isn't this kind of a consumer coercion type case under our Danvers case and the FTC unfairness statement? They're being coerced into buying more than they really need.
I definitely do not believe it's a coercion case at all. I mean, Danvers case is a perfect example. Danvers is a situation where Ford was actually taking 1% off every sale of a vehicle from the Ford dealerships. It was taking money in order to force dealers to participate in this certification program that nobody wanted to participate in. Every time they sold a car, they were being forced to pay 1%. Here, these plaintiffs have been using this medication. They willingly entered into these transactions for years, potentially even decades. And now, after the fact, they've come up with a way that they could potentially be improved, and they want to say that they were forced.
I mean, of each drop, they're only using, 50%. The other 50% goes to waste, and yet they have to use it, don't they?
I mean, that may or may not be.
Maybe.
I mean, you're dropping in a drop, and you might get some on your skin,
right,
some gets
right into
your... I mean, all of this is speculation. All of this is speculation because you have to assume that there's some other product out there that would have been cheaper in order to come up with some pricing differential. I mean, you have to assume that if defense had not engaged in this, whatever this allegedly unlawful act is, using standard FDA-approved dropper tips, that there would have been some dropper tip that was put on there instead that would have saved the plaintiffs money so that they could use the product for even longer. That's their argument. But that's complete speculation.
Have any of the other cases, I know there's several cases similar to this one, been dismissed on standing?
There were two cases in the Eastern District of Missouri that were dismissed on injury under the state consumer protection laws. I don't think the argument was made, the Article 3 standing argument was not made. The IP case in Illinois is now before the Seventh Circuit, and the standing issue is before the Seventh Circuit. The Gustafson case is in the District of Massachusetts. We don't have a final order on that one yet, but the court did indicate orally on the
record. But he was not going to dismiss it on standing.
He was not going to dismiss it on standing.
Where is the Seventh Circuit case procedurally right now?
A class was certified in that case, and we petitioned for review under 26F, and the Seventh Circuit granted it.
Okay.
And the standing issue has now been raised again with the Seventh Circuit.
Was the standing issue raised in the district court?
We raised the injury issue in the district court, and we did cite Article 3 in our motion to dismiss, but the court did not rule on the Article 3 issue at all. So we believe that, as this court should, the Seventh Circuit will also address the standing issue and dismiss on those grounds.
You'll keep us advised about that, right?
We sure will.
Okay.
We sure will. I just want to note one thing. The adverse health effects, that wasn't part of their issue presented. That wasn't part of their opening brief. They brought that up on
the reply. I wonder if it even alleges an injury in fact.
Well, it certainly does not. There is not a single plaintiff who alleges that there have been any adverse health effects at all. And there's actually not a single allegation that anyone out there, anywhere, has suffered any adverse health effects associated with the larger drops.
So I think Nichols made it clear they were pursuing two claims, one based on monetary damages, one of them was not an injury, a physical injury claim.
Correct. There's just a money claim. And to refer back to Finkelman, the distinctions that were attempted to be drawn in Finkelman just don't apply here. In Finkelman, there was the same issue. And, in fact, I think we have an even stronger case that there's no standing here than there was in Finkelman. In Finkelman, the court ruled that, you know, the NFL withheld the tickets, and there's no way of knowing what the resale market would have looked like had the NFL not engaged in that practice.
But those players, Finkelman, one player didn't participate at all, didn't pursue a ticket, and the other one didn't pursue it in the secondary market.
Correct. So those were issues as well. But the court held that the inherent speculative nature of what the market would have looked like had the NFL not withheld the 99% of Super Bowl tickets, that's what they based their opinion on and why there was no injury in fact. Here, we don't even have a Super Bowl market to look at or for an expert to opine on. What we have here is a product that does not even exist. So there's nothing that anyone could do to try to figure out what that market would look like because the product does not exist.
If there is no alternative product, the plaintiffs have asked for an injunction. Can we order an alternative product?
Well, of course not, Judge Roth. That absolutely cannot be ordered by any court because there's a preemption issue, obviously, there. You can't order a company to manufacture a product that would then also have to be approved by the FDA before it even came to market. I mean, I'm not aware of any case ever ordering any company to manufacture a product. I mean, that's the inherent problem with this case. These products exist. They've been working for decades. Plaintiffs have been using them. They've worked perfectly fine for plaintiffs. They're getting the treatment that they need. They're getting every dose that they need. There hasn't been any sort of misrepresentation associated with the product purchases, and yet they still want some of their money back. I mean, my colleague here has argued that as long as they paid money in the past and now they're asking for some of it back, that's enough to state a claim for standing. Well, of course that's not true. You have to have a cognizable legal theory to support your standing. And I think Judge Wolfson did a really good job in her opinion of articulating the various different types of standing theories, of injury theories, that one might use in order to actually have standing in a case like this. So she said, you know, if plaintiffs were promised a certain number of doses or drops and didn't get them, if they were forced to purchase additional prescriptions because they prematurely ran out, if the eye drops didn't perform as intended. I mean, these are all cognizable theories of injury. The theory that plaintiffs are proposing here is it's a packaging inefficiency. It's that the product could be packaged better. As I said before, we could do that. I mean, I can't even imagine how the floodgates would open in that case. We even raised the issue of we argued that this is no different than someone suing over the last few drops of the ketchup bottle or toothpaste in the tube. You know, cars could be made more fuel efficient. Paper towels could be more absorbent. The list goes on. Plaintiff's response to that is that there would actually be Article III standing in those cases. Now, if that's not a red flag to federal courts, as it was to the district court below, then Article III is not functioning as it should. This is really a slippery, a very, very slippery slope. I think if there are no further questions, I can wrap up. I think this is a case that... Do you have another question?
Okay, in the Seventh Circuit, where are they? Has it been fully briefed? Has it been argued?
Oral argument is February 7th.
February 7th, okay.
Yeah, so it's on a similar timeline as this one. You know, as the Supreme...
Do you get to argue?
I'm actually going to... My colleague, it's okay. Mr. Osto, is going to argue.
You're doing a good job, so...
Okay, great. You know, I just close with a Spokeo quote because I think that's important. As the Supreme Court recently stated, no principle is more fundamental to the judiciary's proper role in our system of government than the constitutional limitation of federal court jurisdiction to actual cases or controversies. This is the farthest thing from an actual case or controversy. This is a made-up lawsuit over FDA-approved products that worked exactly as they were supposed to for years and in some cases decades, and this court should not exercise Article III jurisdiction over this case.
Okay. Judge Roth, do you have anything else?
No, I don't.
Okay. Thank you, counsel.
No, I don't.
Thank you.
Why don't you start with the slippery slope argument? Counsel just suggested that you would agree that that the paper towels, the ketchup, all that would lend itself to Article III standing. Do you agree?
Yes, and let me explain this. This is actually exactly where I was going to start. What this court has said, and I'm going to quote, is that all you have to do, it says, for the purposes of a motion to dismiss, quote, the contours of the Injury Act requirement, while not precisely defined, are very generous, requiring only that claimants allege some specific, identifiable trifle of an injury. That's what this court has said with regard to standing. Now, on those cases, now it's interesting because you're talking about the last few drops of ketchup. What happens when it's half the bottle, which is more like this case? Then, you know, it starts to look like there's something there. But standing is an on-off switch. It's not, you know, you're not more injured or less injured for Article III standing purposes. You're either injured or you're not. What takes care of the slippery slope is whether or not the plaintiffs have stated a claim. This court asked about what was going on in the other cases. Have standing been addressed? The answer is no, other than in the Gustafson case in Massachusetts. The answer is no, because those cases involved whether the plaintiffs had stated a claim under state law. State law addresses these questions and deals with it. So, for example, under the New Jersey law on which we sue, there must be, you can't sue over the last couple of drops in ketchup in the ketchup bottle, but you can sue over half, you know, when it's half the ketchup bottle. That's a decision. That's what keeps. It's those that failure to state a claim is what keeps those cases from going forward.
We just laid out a pretty clear legal principle.
Yes.
It's not so easily applied, though. What's the difference between a little and a half? Where do we draw a line? We have to draw it right in opinion here.
Right. Well, that's the difference. Well, that's a question not of Article III standing, but a question of whether the plaintiffs have stated a claim under state law, which is a question that the district court has not reached yet in this case. So, you don't have to answer a question here. That's on remand, a question that the district court would address. The defendants here filed a motion to dismiss for standing and for failure to state a claim and on preemption grounds. So,
right.
Presumably, the district court would move on to the failure to state a claim and the preemption grounds on remand. So, again, that's a question. That's a question of state law, is what kind of claims can you bring? And it's or federal law in the context of a federal statute. It's those substantive laws that take care of those slippery slope arguments and take care of the concerns about those claims that were uncomfortable going forward. Again, the claim here requires substantial injury, so it has to be substantial. Many state claims have a materiality aspect to them, and it requires the not to be reasonably avoidable by consumers. So when we're talking about ketchup bottles and, you know, paper towels and all of those things, those are claims that are not going to go forward, but they're not because of a standing issue, because they failed to state a claim.
And just what about the speculative nature of your claim as framed by counsel, in that the better delivery system does this? We're just speculating here.
So here, this is a case in which it's absolutely feasible for defendants to have already done this. And it's not speculative that they do this. Defendant Alcon, for example, developed a 16-microliter dropper, tested it on patients. It did very well, and then decided not to use it. So, you know, and there are dropper designs that have been published. So all of this idea that there's, you know, this dropper or whatnot doesn't exist simply isn't factually correct. Those designs are out there. They've been tested by some of the defendants already. And so this isn't a case where it's purely theoretical. This is a case where it's already been tested and looked at.
You know, and looking over Judge Wilson's opinion, she seemed to have criticized your replacement cost theory. And is that a criticism of an injury in fact or traceability defect, or is that a redressability issue?
So, and I see I'm out of time.
You go ahead.
All right. So, and now I want to make sure I'm getting at the right part of Judge Wolfson's opinion. This is when the court is talking about
replacement cost theory.
The replacement.
She wasn't impressed.
Right.
Was she really talking about redressability?
Possibly, or causation. I think so. Those are some other aspects but not injury. What was appeared to be the focus of the decision, Judge Wolfson's decision, was the criticism that the plaintiffs hadn't pled deception, hadn't fed defective product, and so on. But that just goes to the substantive nature of the claims. It doesn't go to whether there's an injury here or not. Are there any further questions?
Judge Roth, anything more?
No.
Okay, thank you very much, counsel.
Thank you.
This is a fascinating case. Thank you, counsel, for the excellent briefing and argument. We'll take the case under advisement, and if counsel are willing, Judge Restrepo and I would like to meet counsel at sidebar and congratulate you more personally and thank you more personally. So if we go off the record for a minute, it will come back.